It was a week of homegrown violence and terror in the United States. First, a slew of pipe bombs were sent to prominent critics of President Donald Trump. Then, a racially motivated shooting at a Kroger grocery store that killed two African Americans. Finally, what is believed to be the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in the history of our country. Americans across the nation gathered to mourn the 11 people who were shot and killed in a Pittsburgh synagogue on Saturday. This weekend, a gunman armed with an AR-15 assault rifle and three handguns opened fire inside the Tree of Life Synagogue. He killed 11 worshipers. Most of them were elderly. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto called the attack on the city's Jewish community the darkest day of Pittsburgh's history.
We should be working to eliminate irrational behavior and the empowerment of people who would seek to cause this type of carnage. I think the approach that we need to be looking at is how we take the guns, which is the common denominator of every mass shooting in America, out of the hands of those that are looking to express hatred through murder.
Just before opening fire, the gunman disparaged the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, also known as HIAS, in a hate-filled, anti-Semitic post on social media.
I'm in a state of shock, and all of my colleagues at HIAS are in an absolute state of shock. We're accustomed to being criticized for our work welcoming refugees by some, but this is beyond our worst imagination.
That's Mark Hetfield. He's the president and CEO of HIAS, which helps and protects refugees from all over the world.
Yeah, the real problem infecting our society, and it's really a global problem, is this space of hate. There's so much space for hatred and for hate speech. And what we know is that hateful words always turn into hateful deeds.
And Mark says this hate cannot go unchecked.
It's incumbent upon all of us to call out hate wherever we see it, to make sure that we don't let it pass, whether it's at our Thanksgiving table. We can't just allow our crazy uncle to go off on a racist tirade. We have to call him on it. We have to call our elected officials on it. We have to call our friends and colleagues on it. We just cannot tolerate intolerance. It's just too dangerous.
All of this together, the pipe bombs mailed by a Donald Trump supporter known for making racist and homophobic rants online and in real life, the shooting in Kentucky where the white perpetrator allegedly tried to enter a black church before killing two black people in a grocery store parking lot, the synagogue shooting, it all raises critical questions about the continued rise of white supremacist violence in our nation. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start the conversation today on The Takeaway. With us now is Bruce Hoffman, a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations. Bruce, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're also joined by Bree Newsom Bass, an artist and community organizer in North Carolina. Bree, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bree, let's get started with you. We've seen three acts of violence or attempted violence by three different men this past week. All of them harbored racist or anti-Semitic or other hateful views. What is the context that we find ourselves in today in this country that has been leading to this?
Well, I think it's important to recognize, one, that we have a very long-standing history of racism in this country, obviously, and of white supremacist terrorism of this kind. But particularly in recent years, particularly with the election of the nation's first black president, Obama, we saw an increase in white supremacist activity, an increase in the formation of white supremacist hate groups. And then, of course, the political ascendancy of Donald Trump really has taken place within that context. Of course, he really came to prominence as a political figure by being one of the most outspoken people on this birtherism conspiracy theory, this idea that President Obama was, you know, born in another country, which of course itself is a very racist motivation in that theory. And so in this particular week, the week began with a bomb being sent to George Soros, who, of course, is frequently targeted not only by Donald Trump, but in a lot of right-wing political messaging. And that itself carries a lot of anti-Semitic undertones, the sense that George Soros is funding a lot of activist activity. And then Donald Trump proclaimed himself a nationalist, kind of this wink, wink, nod, nod use of this term nationalist. And then we had this spate of white supremacist terrorist attacks. And this all happened within the course of a week. So I think the week is significant for those events, but we have been building to this for quite some time.
Bruce, I want to bring you in here because I feel like oftentimes, you know, we hear the word, Bree just mentioned the word terrorism. What is the actual definition of terrorism and domestic terrorism today? And how do we see that being applied to the recent acts that we've just been discussing?
Terrorism is, in my view, is ineluctably political. It's always about an intention to intimidate, coerce, punish or otherwise influence someone by violence or the threat of violence. There's a very specific legal definition in the U.S. Code, which in essence conforms to that. But I think what leaves people very confused is that there's a completely separate code for hate crimes. And to boil it down to its essence, I would say that something is labeled terrorism or domestic terrorism based on the intention of the perpetrator. And that is something you can imagine that even if you know who the perpetrator is, the authorities want to have rock solid evidence, proof, in other words, that their motivation was indeed within this political framework.
When we talk about these folks in media more broadly, when we talk about mass shooters or folks that are doing committing these bigger acts of what many would describe as terrorism, we often call them, especially if they're white males, lone wolf attacks. And my question to you, Bruce, and I'd love to hear from you as well, Bree, is that there's clearly some sort of radicalization happening of American white men in particular. Where does that fall, Bruce, on the spectrum of terrorism?
Oh, incontrovertibly, I think that one would see that as terrorism if it has a political intent. And the reason I'm emphasizing that is, of course, a little bit more than a year ago, a shooter at the Las Vegas hotel opened fire on concert goers and killed nearly 60 people. That may have terrorized people, may have caused profound fear and anxiety in the United States amongst people who gather at public venues, that because of the firearms laws in this country, that they could be victim to such attacks. But we still, a year later, do not know the motive or the intention of the shooter. And that's why that has never been labeled terrorism.
But Bruce, I want to stop you right there. We will never know the motive. And I think that's what's most frustrating for a lot of people when we often don't know the motives, for example, of international terrorists, right? Or we can assume that they're just anti-American is something that I think comes up often in conversation. But we won't know the motive of the Las Vegas shooter because that person is no longer here. When these folks take their own lives, when they commit violent acts in public, why is that not considered a terrorist attack?
Right, but even people who perish in the course of their attack or commit suicide immediately afterwards, on occasion, have contextualized it, have put it in the context of some political cause or of allegiance to or belief in or support of the ideology of a movement. And an instance where we just have someone randomly opening fire without putting in that context, in the legal context, it can't be terrorism. But you're absolutely right. In a normative sense, what society regards as terrorism is something obviously very, very different. But your point about lone wolves absolutely is regarded as a terrorist act. It is seen as a deliberate strategy of terrorist organizations to radicalize, to inspire, to motivate, and ultimately animate lone individuals to carry out acts of violence on their behalf. And I don't think there's much doubt that that's terrorism. What's so important in this context is that entire lone wolf concept was developed over 30 years ago by white supremacists in the United States as a means to push back against the success that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies were having in basically shutting down their much more organized and overtly conspiratorial activities. And it was a former Texas Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, Louis Beam, who came up with this idea of lone wolf or leaderless resistance type terrorism that, unfortunately, we see played out across the country today.
Bree, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, on the sort of the lone wolf attacks, but also the idea that there are whites being radicalized in the United States and the limits of how we call that terrorism or not.
Yeah, certainly. I think that the frustration for civil rights activists like myself and that you see expressed from many of the communities that are most vulnerable, most often subject to attack from white supremacists, is not simply with whether or not we are labeling these acts of violence terrorism, but whether or not we are acknowledging white supremacy as a political ideology. This was something that we debated back in 2015 when Dylann Roof entered Mother Emanuel and shot and killed 9 black parishioners there in Charleston. There was a similar kind of debate. Well, is it terrorism? Well, we don't know what his motive is. To murder people of color because you believe that the United States should be a white nation is a political motive. It is an explicitly political motive. Again, we can't talk about how people are being radicalized without having an honest conversation about white supremacy as an ideology, as a longstanding political ideology and struggle in this nation. This is a nation that over 150 years ago had a civil war over the issue of slavery, over the issue of whether or not Black Americans could be counted as people, could be counted as citizens. In the aftermath of the Civil War, we had the period of Reconstruction, which I think is arguably very similar to the political conditions that we are seeing today. You have a higher level of participation from people of color in the electoral system. And in response to that, you have a white supremacist backlash that in most recent years has been kind of signified or symbolized by the political ascendancy of Donald Trump and this movement of Make America Great Again itself kind of implies this return to a prior period. Well, now, people like myself know that in prior periods of the United States, we were not allowed to be citizens. So to not acknowledge that this racism that we are seeing, that this violence that we are seeing is inherently political, it's not simply it cannot simply be boiled down to an issue of hate and someone feeling personal animosity towards someone else, you know. And it makes sense that white supremacist groups, particularly in the 70s, as the FBI was starting to kind of crack down on them, would try to, you know, steer us more towards this narrative of there being these lone wolf actors. But the reality is that white supremacist groups are organized. You have extremist white supremacist groups, and you also have white supremacist ideology in the mainstream. And that is part of the conflict that we have been discussing this week in terms of what role or what influence, right, does Trumpism have on normalizing this kind of hate and this kind of political ideology? It's not simply hate. It is, in fact, a political ideology.
And Bruce, we've heard a lot under this administration from the president of the United States that, you know, we've seen from the Muslim ban to pointing fingers at groups that are violent, like MS-13, that have committed terrible acts of violence as the real threat here. And yet, in just 1 week, we've seen 3 attacks that were homegrown. These were domestic acts of terrorism and violence. So what or who is really the biggest threat to our domestic security right now, Bruce?
Well, 2 things. Firstly, the 21st century has turned out to be an enormously insecure time on any number of levels, both in terms of political violence and terrorism, but also in terms of an order that is rapidly shifting. And, you know, we have a spectrum of threats, and it's difficult to distinguish what's the worst and what's the most threat. They're all threatening and they're all bad because they all kill individuals and they all target individuals.
But Bruce, I have to say that I've never walked into a school or my place of work and thought and was really afraid for my safety and my life. I think most Americans these days would say they didn't ever think about being afraid for their lives when they go to the movies or when they go to a dance club. I mean, this is something I feel that's clearly different.
Yes. Well, it is. It is. There's no doubt about it. But we shouldn't lose sight of what Bree said earlier. Throughout United States history, at times of great divisiveness, polarization, alienation, we have seen an uprise repeatedly in this kind of violence before and after the Civil War, in the late 19th century, during the period of industrialization and modern communications. We saw two presidents assassinated within 20 years of one another, certainly in the 1960s and 70s. I think that, you know, terrorism and hate crimes rest and sit along the fault lines of our society and what we're seeing right now. And you're quite right. It is far more acute now than it's been in our modern memories. But don't forget, one 18-month period between 1971 and 1972, there were 2,500 terrorist bombings in the United States. So this isn't in terms of the violence unprecedented, but in terms of the mood that both you and Bree have described, I mean, absolutely, there's been a change. I think that the security we felt in recent years has almost completely eroded.
Bree, let's talk about that a little bit, because you've done perhaps one of the most visible acts of resistance when you took down the Confederate flag. Tell us a little bit about how the activist community is reacting to these recent events.
Well, I think that most of us view this as a resurgence of violence that has been a constant in this nation. And I think that it's dangerous and in many ways ahistorical to try to lump white supremacist violence in with all other forms of terrorism. For one, white supremacist terrorism is the most common form of terrorism in the United States and always has been. You have to remember, at one point, Birmingham, Alabama was referred to as Bombingham because the number of bombs that were being set off at the homes of Black residents who were trying to vote. Part of the problem of lumping white supremacist terrorism in with Islamic terrorism and some of these other forms of terrorism that are named is that white supremacist terrorism is unique in America in that it has a mainstream stake in the politics. A lot of the views that are being espoused by these white supremacist terrorists are not far removed from the views that are being espoused by the GOP and particularly by Trump. You don't see as much pushback in terms of labeling Islamic terrorism as Islamic terrorism, because it doesn't have the same implications for American society. America is not a majority Muslim nation. However, the ideology of white supremacy is very much in the mainstream of America. Now, of course, we have made a lot of progress from where we were in the past, but to discuss what is happening now in a way that discounts the centuries and generations of this type of violence that we have seen in this country, again, I don't see the value in doing that.
Bruce Hoffman is a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Bree Newsom Bass is an artist and community organizer in North Carolina. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. You're so welcome. Much.
And we're hearing from you. Do you feel like hate is on the rise in this country?
This is Barry Wynn calling from Brighton, Michigan. Hate is just being unleashed. We've never had a shortage in this country. To suggest otherwise is ahistorical and naive. We haven't had a government and media working together in concert to promote it in a long time.
My name's Emma, and I live in Portland, Oregon. And I've seen firsthand just how much vocal hate groups have become in the last year, 2 years since the election. I've had friends who've been tear gassed during protests against the Proud Boys. It's definitely a scary time here.
Hi, I am calling from Ohio. No, I do not think that hate is on the rise. The news just pays attention irregularly to splashy events.
My name is Amy Plaster, calling from High Ridge, Missouri. I believe that ignorance fed by isolation is on the rise. Hate is just one byproduct of this problem.
This is Sydney Elkin from Moultrie, Georgia. I don't think that hate is on the rise. I think it's the same amount of hate that we've always had. However, before now, people knew it wasn't acceptable by society to spout nasty things. I don't believe that these are hate crimes. I believe that they are terrorism.
Hi, this is Lizzie from Monroe, North Carolina. There has always been hate, but we have to rise above that and be the best person we can be. We have to love our neighbor, support our families, and look out for each other.
Hi, my name is Larry Fisher. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York. There will never be gun control in this country. It will always be gun out of control. And the best thing that Americans can do now is hope that they're witness to some gun shooting and that they don't get shot, because it's a lottery right now.
My name is Bridget. I live in Pittsburgh, PA, Squirrel Hill area, and I'm really angry and really sad, and it was very frightening. But it also proved to me how strong our community is when everybody turned out for the vigil last night. And it's just making us stronger. We all need to be together. And I think the most important thing is we have to start voting for people to get in office that will change the gun laws. And I don't want to live under a military state, so I don't think Army and Guard are the answer.
Your thoughts there on the violence of the past week. Join in on the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page.
Support for the Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, or German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com.